Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. I'm the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 22nd of August. According to the CDC, if HIV continues to spread at its current rate, more than half of college-aged gay men will have HIV by the age of 50. When looking at other parts of the HIV situation, the CDC found this, that new HIV infections remained steady in the general public between 2008 and 2010, but those infections had risen by an incredible 22% in young gay men. They now represent two-thirds of new infections, and nearly 6,000 gay men were dying of AIDS each year. There are life-saving drug regimens that can prevent HIV infection, and yet few know about their availability. So this hour, we will talk about why the rise in new HIV infections among young gay men and what some of those drugs are. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. Here's how you reach us this hour. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Joining us to start the show is Matthew Rodriguez. He is the editorial project manager for TheBody.com, which is the web's most comprehensive HIV/AIDS resource. Matthew, hello, and thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm happy to be here.
I'm absolutely amazed, Matthew, when I read about the fact that gay men, young gay men, have seen an infection increase by 22%. I don't think this is very widely known. Do you?
No, I don't think it's widely known. I think that in general, what's going on among young gay men, especially young gay men of color, is not talked about as widely as it should be. And I don't think people know exactly what direction the HIV epidemic in America is going right now.
Why is it that we haven't been paying attention to this? Is there somebody who's at fault?
I don't know if it's at fault specifically. I think that there's a list or a lot of contributing factors to why this isn't being spoken about. I think part of it is that now people believe, or in a sense, HIV is a chronic manageable disease. And there's not, I'm sure for people who lived in the 80s and 90s who saw people getting physically sicker, there was a lot of visibility around HIV. And now with people not being visibly sick, there's less talk around it. And then also, you know, in that we lost a generation of gay men, I think there's also not as many, you know, we lost also a generation of mentors and models of people who could talk to young gay men and talk to us about our health mm-hmm. and how to engage in smarter, safer sex practices.
So we've forgotten the education campaign.
Correct. I think education needs to be a central, you know, a central tenet of any HIV prevention strategy. And we have lost that. And, you know, in schools, I don't think some schools are even allowed to say the word gay or allude to the fact that there are gay men and that we have sex. And then, you know, how do you get to a young gay man who is just entering the world of dating or talking about sex if you can't say those words in a classroom?
Right. There has been some criticism of the major LGBT groups in the United States focusing most of their attention, understandably so because of the Supreme Court decision, but focusing attention on gay marriage, workplace non-discrimination protections, safe schools, corporate support, and benefits for employees. Absent from that list, of course, is HIV/AIDS. Do those organizations that were so important in getting this country to recognize what was going on with AIDS back in the 80s need to start paying more attention? Are they the natural organizations to spread the word?
I think that they should be. I happen to be in agreement with the people who say that major LGBT organizations are not paying enough attention to HIV. And I think that I don't know if the term is a double-edged sword or, you know, it works both ways in that. I think along somewhere along the way in the messaging with HIV, where it is true that HIV can happen to anyone, and that everyone should be engaging in safer sex practices for themselves to keep themselves healthy. I think when that messaging started happening, people in the LGBT community started to distance themselves from the message that HIV is a gay disease. But I still consider HIV a community disease that affects the LGBT community disproportionately in America. And as we were just talking about, the numbers show it, that gay men, and especially gay men of color, disproportionately are affected by HIV. And, you know, I think it is funnier and rosier to talk about gay marriage and to fight for that. But I think that there is a big component missing when you're not talking about the health of our community.
What is the reason, Matthew, that gay men of color are experiencing such high infection rates?
I think there's a lot of different factors that go into why people of color and gay men of color disproportionately shoulder the burden of HIV in America. I think a lot of it just happens, you know, with things like institutional racism in America. I think that poverty disproportionately affects people of color. So a lot of gay men of color find themselves in living in poverty. They also usually have less of an access or a lack of access to education. And if they're in schools that are doing worse, that don't have as good health programs, they might not be getting messaging as well. And then also just with racism and homophobia comes a lot of self-esteem issues. You know, if I don't respect myself, if I don't care for myself, if I think that society doesn't care for me, then there's really nothing stopping me from, you know, having sex without a condom, because I'm not going to ask you to respect my body if I feel like people don't respect me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot of levels of people kind of falling through the cracks, and gay men of color live at the intersection of so many different identities and different stigmas that it can be very hard to push back against that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned schools not talking about this. I remember the 1980s and how everybody was saying that we needed very direct, very explicit education programs in every school in this country. Do you have a handle on how schools are dealing with this issue? Are most of them at least talking about it, or is it absent from the curriculum in a majority of schools? What's the situation?
I don't have the complete answer to that. I think through my work that I've done in New York City, I have even just a minor grasp on how it's happening in New York City. And from what I understand, you know, HIV is a topic among many that students get when they encounter sexual health curricula. And so a lot of, I think from what I understand, my friend I have friends who are within the New York City public school system. From what I understand, it's that they are given curricula, but it's often very much up to the teacher. And if the teacher doesn't feel like teaching HIV, then the students may not get an HIV education. It may, you know, if they just want to stick with the condom, or if they just want to stick to this is what STIs are, or if they even don't want to go that deep, it's kind of up to the teacher sometimes. The curricula are very vague.
And maybe this information that we started the show with, that half of college-age gay men will have HIV by the age of 50, maybe if that piece of information were distributed, everybody would take notice of it, because I sure did.
Right. And, you know, I find myself in that, you know, I'm part of that demographic, and I do want anyone listening to understand that when I'm talking as someone who is recently out of college. I'm only 24, and I'm a young gay man of color. And, you know, that statistic speaks to me, because it's one of those statistics where this is an extrapolation on where current trends are going. And, you know, you said the 22% in the past few years, we've seen infections on the rise among young gay men. And this is where we're headed, but I don't think it's a statistic that has to be. And one of the things that I do, both in my job at thebody.com and as an activist with ACT UP, is, you know, try to empower young gay men of color to have that self-esteem, saying that, you know, you don't have to be a statistic. There are ways for you to avoid contracting HIV. And this isn't something that, you know, is a definite. You can be on the other side of 50%, and we can lower the 50%, but it does have to be a community effort.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be a community effort. It's not always solely up to the person.
Mm-hmm. And I know that ACT UP, at least in New York, has been drawing attention to this issue.
Yes, we have. I think, so with ACT UP, one of the things that we're talking about is that we've kind of named this epidemic, or what's going on right now, as AIDS 2.0, because it's a different epidemic than the one we saw in the 80s, and that's what I was speaking about earlier. It's one that's not going to be as visible. It's one that's not going to be in people's faces. You're not going to see people in the hospital dying with cancer on their or Kaposi sarcoma on their face. It's going to be one that just silently sees a lot of gay men zero converting or going from HIV negative to HIV positive, and it's not going to be as in your face. So it is really more of a silent epidemic this time around, which is why ACT UP wants to make noise around it.
Mm-hmm. Also joining our conversation now is James Krellenstein. He's a research intern in the Department of Immunology and Microbiology at the City University of New York Medical School, and he is also a member of ACT UP in New York. James, thank you so much for joining our conversation. Hello.
Hi, this is Mark Milano.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Mark. Well, all right, Mark. Thanks very much for being with us. Mark has been an HIV health and treatment educator for over 20 years. He is editor of Achieve, which reports on HIV treatment, prevention, and politics. So thank you so much, Mark, for being with us.
Sure. Sorry I'm late.
That's okay. We were talking with Matthew about this fairly dramatic and I think rather unknown news. The other thing that's perhaps not as well known is that there are drugs here that could be very important in keeping people from becoming infected with HIV/AIDS. Can you talk about those drugs, what they are, and why they are not widely used?
Sure. Well, they're quite effective from the studies so far, but there certainly are barriers to their use. So it's two drugs that are combined in one pill called Truvada. Truvada is used very extensively among people with HIV to treat HIV infection. It's an antiviral drug that actually suppresses the virus. And there was a large study done in which there were two groups. One received Truvada and one received placebo. And these were gay men who were, and transgender women, I believe, who were considered at high risk for HIV infection. When you do a study like that, you have to encourage everyone to use condoms, because condoms are highly effective, proven highly effective, and you can't ask them to abandon a highly effective method for an unproven method. But of course, you assume that people are not going to use condoms because not everybody uses condoms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you find in any vaccine study or any study like this to prevent HIV infection, you're assuming that some people are not going to use condoms, so you're going to see some infections during the course of the study. So what the study found was that compared to placebo, Truvada was 44% effective in reducing the risk of HIV infection. Now, that doesn't sound very impressive, but when you look at the actual number of people who took the drug, that 44% includes people in the Truvada arm who never even took the Truvada. You have to do the analysis that way.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at those who actually took the drug, and you do that by looking at the levels of drug in their blood, so among those who actually took the drug, I believe the figure was 92%, certainly over 90% effective. So that study and some other studies have shown that this drug, if taken every day, is highly effective at preventing HIV. The problem with this, of course, is that this means somebody who is HIV negative, who does not have HIV, has to take a pill every single day to prevent a disease that they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually pretty difficult for people with HIV who have the virus to take these pills every day because you forget and there are other things that get in the way. So taking the pills when you don't have the disease, you know, has, as the study showed, proven to be difficult for people. But if you do take the pill every day, it does appear to be quite effective. Now, 90% is not 100%. And, you know, you ask somebody, if you were having sex with somebody who you know has HIV and you were taking a pill that still gave you a 10% chance of getting HIV, would you have unprotected sex with them? You know, would that 10% number be too high for you,
mm-hmm.
or would you be comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not 100%. Condoms used correctly are over 99% effective. But as we know, condoms, you know, have been shown to not be used by the majority of people who are having sex, the vast majority of people having sex,
and
after all these years.
Which is pretty remarkable. We were talking to Matthew about this. Is this the result of being very, very lax on an education campaign?
There have been many discussions as to why let's focus on gay men and men who have sex with men who clearly know that there is a risk in sex. And we talk about, you know, why they're not using condoms. I'll tell you one story, actually an article that we carried in Achieve, of a young African-American man, 22 years old, who only had sex with men, but said he was not gay. Didn't identify as gay, even though he only had sex with men.
Mm-hmm.
And what he told me was that if he went to a friend's house and they watched movies and played video games and then just had sex, that was just two guys fooling around. It didn't mean either of them were gay. If he went there carrying a condom, that meant he went there intending to have sex, and that meant he was gay. So even the act of coming with a condom to the apartment made him identify as gay, which he didn't want to do because there's a lot of homophobia, you know, in his community. So you see that there are psychological barriers. Drug use certainly gets in the way of using condoms. Alcohol use gets in the way of using condoms. Many gay men are attempting to use serosorting, where you screen out everybody who is HIV positive. And, of course, I think you can see that you can't do that. We estimate that the majority of infections are coming from people who think they're HIV negative but are actually HIV positive. So you ask your partner, are you HIV negative? They say, yes, I am. And then you somehow think, I don't need a condom because right. the person is negative. So there are multiple levels of barriers that can get in the way mm-hmm. of using condoms. It's not a simple matter of condoms protect me from HIV, therefore I will always use a condom. It's not, people, you think obviously that would be the case, but it's not that simple.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about homophobia in the African-American community, and I would assume from what Matthew said in the Latino community as well, and how that's being addressed. You feel sometimes that the country is going another way with the Supreme Court decision and gay marriage becoming legal in more and more states, but it would appear that there are a number of people who psychologically, because of how their community feels about this, can't come out. And what does that do to you? We have a couple guests with us. Mark Milano, who has been an HIV health and treatment educator for a number of years. Matthew Rodriguez is a young 24-year-old gay man who is the editorial project manager for TheBody.com, and he also works with ACT UP New York. And in just a moment, we'll also meet James Krellenstein, a research intern in the Department of Immunology and Microbiology at the SUNY Medical School and a member of ACT UP New York. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking this hour about all the ramifications and the reasons behind this remarkable piece of news from the CDC. HIV, if it continues to spread at its current rate, more than half of college-age men will have HIV by the age of 50. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We introduce as well now to our conversation, and then we'll start going to your many phone calls, which are coming in right now. James Krellenstein, he's a research intern in the Department of Immunology and Microbiology at the SUNY Medical School and is a member of ACT UP New York. James, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
We were talking earlier with Mark about the drugs that are on the market right now, and in addition to figuring out how effective they are and that condoms may be even more effective. I had a question about how available these drugs are. Are they expensive? Can you get them through health insurance? Are people availing themselves of these drugs?
So that's actually a great question. So without insurance, Truvada, which is the drug that is used for PrEP, is probably about $800 to $1,000 to even up to about $1,200 a month.
Whoa!
So it's not a cheap drug at all. If you have insurance and your insurance covers PrEP, and PrEP is now, you know, it's an FDA indication for the drug. It's been approved. So a lot of insurance do cover it. You know, you can expect to pay up to $100 in a copay per month. So it's not cheap, and we really haven't seen actually a widespread deployment of PrEP to even highly at-risk people, right? I mean, there are, you know, we know of a few, you know, a few prescriptions going on, but it's not really out in the community. Awareness of it, even in a place like New York City, is very low. A recent study put it at somewhere below 40% of high-risk people. So it's not really widely deployed, and the cost is obviously a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. So what needs to be done about that?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, we really need to redo the way we do HIV education, especially to high-risk individuals like men who have sex with men and trans women, and, you know, get it in the gay community in general. But I think that we have to introduce PrEP as sort of, you know, a component of this sort of armory against HIV, of one of the things that can be used for people to prevent infection, in addition to condoms, in addition to PEP, in addition to other techniques that are out there. I don't think it's, you know, a silver bullet that alone can end the epidemic. I think we have to sort of take like a, you know, a comprehensive approach to this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And may I add something?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, I would just like to add that I think also there needs to be an education around PrEP for healthcare providers, because I've been hearing from PrEP activists that there are doctors who are scared to prescribe this to their patients, and the patients actually have to do the research online, come to them with the FDA approval and the studies like the IPREC study that show the above 90% efficacy for people who want to be on PrEP. So I think there also needs to be education among healthcare providers to say, you know, it's a person's choice if they want to go on PrEP. I think there are a lot, you know, and doctors may have some, you know, be tepid about it, but in the end, if the person comes with the knowledge and the information and they want to explore PrEP, then that education for medical providers needs to be there.
And what about this other drug, PEP, this post-exposure prophylaxis? What does that do?
So post-exposure prophylaxis, basically the idea is that, you know, after the exposure, if you realize that you had an unsafe exposure, for instance, if the condom broke, or if one night you just didn't use a condom for whatever reason, within 36 hours, and ideally within about 2 hours of the exposure, you know, the sooner the better, you can basically go on a full regimen of HIV drugs for a month, for about 28 days, and it's been shown to significantly reduce the chance that you actually become permanently infected with the virus.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, you know, PEP, you know, access to PEP is even more sort of urgent because you need to get it as soon as possible, right? So we have had problems in New York. I mean, we've documented over 12 cases at prestigious academic medical centers where people present to the emergency department saying that I had an unsafe exposure, you know, the condom broke, and they're either not given PEP at all. You know, literally we had one person who was turned away from the emergency department saying that this treatment didn't exist. They didn't know about the treatment. Or it's, you know, put on the back burner and it takes 10 hours or 12 hours or in some cases over a day for the people to get started on the medications, despite the fact that we know that every hour, every minute that you delay starting the regimen, you increase your risk of
HIV infection.
Right. And how effective is this drug?
So there's not really great data on how effective PEP is because it's very unethical to not to give like a placebo to someone who had just been, you know, possibly exposed to HIV. But the observational data indicates about 80% effectiveness in reducing the probability that you become permanently infected with HIV, which is quite significant.
Yeah, there was a study in San Francisco of over 400 gay men who went on PEP, and there were no seroconversions. But unfortunately, people who in that study who didn't complete PEP, didn't go on PEP, also no one seroconverted. So it was hard to ferret out what, you know, the result was from the PEP and what result was from there actually wasn't a significant exposure.
Right. I mean, the 80% number basically comes from an observational study that was done.
I see.
Actually in healthcare workers who were exposed to HIV.
I do want to clarify one thing you said about the CDC data of 1 in 2. That was 1 in 2 young men who have sex with men, not all college-age men. It was men who have sex with men.
Mm-hmm.
Right. 1 in 2 will be positive by 50, not all men.
Mm-hmm.
And that study was actually done by the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, right, based on CDC data. But the actual model was done by the University of Pittsburgh, actually.
Matthew, let me ask you, because you're in this young demographic and you are a gay young man, so you would be at risk in this area. Do you and your friends know about these drugs? Is it something that's talked about?
I think that PrEP is not as widely known among young gay men. I mean, I would say that I'm not the perfect control study to ask because I'm plugged in. I'm plugged in myself, and then I start these conversations with people.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that, first of all, PrEP is and continues to be almost controversial, even in the HIV community. So I would, I want to know what I don't know exactly what people outside the HIV community think about it, but I do know that when I've spoken about it with people just randomly, it's not something that is that not everyone has a knowledge about, and some people even seem kind of trepidatious about talking about it. So I think that there does need to be a kind of breakdown of the stigma around it and of the idea of what it really means to take control of your own health.
Right. Let's go.
I'll say just also, if I may add, I'm a young gay man as well. I'm 22.
Oh, my.
And there's not any real awareness, not only of PrEP or PEP, but about this reemergent epidemic that we're seeing that really is this sort of almost existential threat to our community,
yes,
to our generation.
Yes, I know.
And it's really, that's what's even disturbing. We're not even talking about the fact
that really
the first step
that's
to
kind
solving
of,
a problem is admitting you have one.
Right.
We're not even doing that.
Right.
There's also a surprising lack of awareness among young gay men of how to have safer sex. Many young gay men feel that any sex with a person with HIV is high risk, which, of course, is not the case. So, we need to re-educate young gay men that it's entirely possible to have sex with someone who has HIV and not get infected. It's not that difficult to do, but there's a real fear of that out there now. So they're kind of giving up completely, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655. Mary in Madison is our first caller. Gentlemen, hello, Mary. Mary, are you there? Well, I think everything's working here. Well, I know what she wanted to talk about, so let's get back to the issue of homophobia among certain communities in this country. She said that her son just came out, and her son's partner is African-American. I don't know where exactly she was going to go with this. Let's just assume that the African-American young male is having problems letting people know that he is gay. What kind of conversation does she need to have with both of them, if she can have a conversation with both of them?
I think there's been a clear correlation in studies about stigma and homophobia and its impact on the ability to stay HIV negative. You know, the more you are in the closet, the more you have difficulty accessing information about HIV and safer sex, the more difficult it is to, you know, see yourself at risk and to take precautions to protect yourself. You kind of, that stigma leads to denial. Denial leads to, you know, a lack of self-protection, which leads to HIV infection. And I think all of us would agree that one of the drivers of this 1 in 2 figure is stigma and homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is also really fascinating that when we look at the data, actually, what we're seeing is that in, for instance, African-American males, men who have sex with men, which we have this double to triple, you know, infection rate compared to white men who have sex with men, we don't see really that higher rates of unprotected sex or of risky behavior, right? So what is really driving the epidemic is just a lack of awareness and lack of access to health care and a lack of access to, you know, health care that is targeting sexual health. So one of the real ways that we need to address this epidemic is by addressing homophobia and addressing stigma and really trying to sort of start people having these conversations with their healthcare providers or having them find a healthcare provider who is, you know, open and receptive and understands what's
yeah.
going on.
Right.
I think that's really important.
And I think the tone around sex among young gay men of color needs to change. The tone of this, it should be a sex and the talk discussion around sex should be about liberation and like how can sex be an expression of love and also be physically pleasing. But right now among a lot of young gay men, I think that sex is something that is scary and people think that, oh, I'm going to get infected, and it's something like people are watching for HIV. And even though that there are ways to have safer sex, the conversation around sexual education, especially when you're in communities of color, needs to be a positive one about how is the best way to engage in this thing that feels good and lets me, you know, connect with someone else on a, you know, in a certain way.
How do you, and this is kind of a large question, I don't know how you go about doing this, but how do you deal with a general homophobia in a community? How do you counter that? What do you say?
Very much in the African-American community is to try to get to the churches, to get the churches talking about HIV. I know people who have gone to the First Wives, the minister of the church, to go to his wife, who is very powerful in that parish, and get her on board and get the church talking about HIV, because for many years African American churches would not discuss HIV at all. So I think the churches are one important inroad, because fear of HIV and homophobia are very strong, unfortunately, in African American churches.
Do you think that's changing as the country starts changing on gay marriage? And the country's really changed somewhat dramatically in the last couple of years.
The country is changing, but you know, here in New York City, we've had a horrible spate of anti-gay attacks.
Really?
People being killed and
really?
Beaten. One just happened last week. So, you know, when gay rights move forward, homophobes get angry and fight back. So while we're seeing a move forward, we're seeing a response to that of, even in New York City, surprisingly scary number of attacks on gay people.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, we need to speak to HIV with us as not as separate from these other issues, because I feel like there are certain groups in New York City that are specifically targeted towards young gay men of color. And I spoke at an event at GMHC called Save Our Sons. I was about young gay men of color. And a lot of the panelists said, you know, when you talk to these young people, even though marriage equality is, I think, what people think is on the agenda nationally, to these young gay men of color and young people of color, that's not really even in their top 10 of what they're talking about. They're more talking about surviving and living. And that's, we need to cater the message to them, because that's not really what they're talking about. And I think when I hear that people are advocating for marriage equality, or, you know, people are donating their money, I think, you know, that's great. But I think in the end, the people who donate money to marriage equality are thinking, oh, this money's going to come back to me and benefit me in some way because I want to get married. But if you were to work for young gay men of color or anybody in the LGBT LGBT of color community, I think it would be more beneficial, and it's more of a proactive public health stance saying, like, yes, this isn't about me, but this is where my attention need to be. I think it's about not just advocating for yourself and what you want to do, but realizing there are people in your community who are at high risk for infection.
Yeah. Matthew, what are your thoughts on this issue?
I'm sorry?
Matthew? No.
That was the one who was just speaking.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So it's James we need to hear from.
Right, yeah. So I think sort of piggybacking on what Matthew said in general is I think, first of all, the homophobia issue in communities of color is something that we really as a community, just from a gay rights perspective, really need to work on and really need to sort of change the conversation about. But I think going back to HIV for a second, I think we have to realize that this is a gay rights issue as well, and a very, very important one. What does it mean when we're talking about 50% of a community being dependent on a pharmaceutical company, on an insurance company, on the government for their very survival? I mean, there's no more important gay rights issue that's facing our community, regardless of whether we're a gay man of color or you know, a white gay man or whatever. We as a community need to address this epidemic, this emergency, because if we don't address it now, it is going to be a gigantic political liability and a gigantic gay rights issue in, 20 years, when my generation literally has to bargain for their collective lives, for their collective survival.
Yeah.
And that's what scares me, and that's really what has sort of motivated me to get involved in this fight, mm-hmm. is that... we watched 300,000 gay men die of this disease already over the past 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
We can't repeat that history. Mm-hmm. We can't let my whole generation become dependent on whoever for their very survival. I mean, there's no more important gay rights issue. Marriage is important too, of course, but we're talking about, a fundamental human right, which is health.
Right. Life, being able to live. Mark, I don't think you were with us at the beginning of the hour. We spent a lot of time talking with Matthew about why the general public is not aware of these dire statistics. Can you explain why that's the case? Because you can hardly pay attention to the issue until you know what the issue is.
Yeah, I think people put blinders on. Heterosexual America is not particularly concerned about LGBT issues, and I find even among many of my liberal straight friends in New York City, it's just not on their radar. So they feel, oh, those are a different group. They have their problems. But Matthew, I think, brings up a very good point among young gay men of color that there are a whole bunch of other issues on their agenda before HIV. They're trying to find a job. They're trying to stay away from violence on their streets. They're dealing with stop and frisk here in New York City. They may, be dealing with drug dealers or drug use themselves. There's, a tremendous hierarchy of need that it's not just about let's get them condoms. It's about, helping them, find a way to survive in this century in the U.S. And to survive as a gay man, to be able to say openly, this is who I am, I'm not ashamed of this. Those are all things that I think need to happen before we can just throw condoms at them.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls on this important topic. This hour we're talking about a recent CDC report suggesting that 1 in 2 gay men who are having sex with other men under the age of 30 will contract the HIV virus by the age of 50. Our guests are Mark Milano, who's been an HIV health and treatment educator for 20 years. He is the editor of the publication Achieve, which reports on HIV treatment, prevention, and politics. James Krellerstein is a research intern at the Department of Immunology and Microbiology at the SUNY Medical School. He's a member of ACT UP New York. He sounds like he's an older man, but he is 22 years old. So he's in this very group that we're paying attention to. And Matthew Rodriguez is 24 years old. He's the editorial project manager for TheBody.com, which is the web's most comprehensive HIV/AIDS resource. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. What do you make of these statistics? Have you heard them before? Do you have an understanding of what's going on in terms of education in Wisconsin schools or in churches or however this information is distributed? Do we need some really top-notch and pretty darn thorough sex education programs addressing this? Two more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Patricia is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hello, Patricia.
Hey, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good. I was just listening into the conversation, and each of the gentlemen has some good points. But one of the things I'm missing is the personal responsibility. You know, I'm a lesbian, and I know a lot of gay men who refuse to wear condoms. A lot of the young gay boys don't want to do it. They just find it okay and cool to not use a condom. And it's like I lost a lot of friends back in the days to HIV and to AIDS. And it's like a lot of the young gentlemen do not have personal responsibility anymore. And that's what I felt missing in this conversation.
Patricia, thanks for the call. Matthew, let's put that one to you first.
Well, I think that, you know, it's a good question, but I think that there's a lot of different reasons why someone may not choose to put on a condom. I was saying before at the early part of the hour that some people want sex to be pleasurable, and some people don't find sex pleasurable with a condom, and that is why we were talking about pre-exposure prophylaxis as something, PrEP, as something that might be useful. You know, there's a kind of sense sometimes to tell gay men to put on a condom, and even though that is safe sex or this, you know, a method of safer sex, you know, the way that the human race proliferates is through sex without a condom. So I think that anyone is allowed to have sex without a condom. And I think what we're talking about here is that unfairly, gay men, when they enter the dating pool, they're entering an environment where a good portion of the people that they might encounter might be HIV positive. And they're somehow trying to negotiate a lot of things going on. They're trying to negotiate, I want to have pleasurable sex. I want to show this person that I love them. I want to keep myself healthy. I want to, you know, engage with this person in sex. But there's so many things going on in their head. We can't fault someone who doesn't use a condom. You know, that's up until when HIV first happened, I mean, all of human history was sex without a condom.
And let's add that I think very few gay men actually make the decision before sex, I refuse to wear a condom. It happens because of human nature. In the heat of sex, in the heat of passion, you know, the condom comes off or doesn't go on. And by the way, huge double standard. You know, straights, the vast majority of straight people do not use condoms. And yet, you know, nobody really gets down on them. So it's not, you know, always a simple thing. And it sex is sex. And as we know, sex oftentimes does not happen the way we intend it to happen.
Well, let me take issue with this because we have three boys in our family, and they are heterosexual. I got to tell you, one of the first conversations anybody had in the house when it came to sex, when they became sexually active, was here are the condoms. Here's why you need to use condoms for everybody's sake. You don't want pregnancy, you know, for sexually transmitted diseases, etc. It seems to me as though it's just sort of a fact of life that be you gay or straight, the use of condoms may not be as pleasurable, but they might be important.
The conversation absolutely should happen, and I commend you for doing that, but that doesn't mean that all of your sons are going to use a condom every time they have sex.
Right.
You know, we need
right.
to do the education, but it doesn't automatically translate into behavior.
But on the education note, I think one of the things that we are lacking is education that is talking about this epidemic in gay men, right? I mean, basically, when you have the vast majority of new infections happening in gay men,
right?
You know, we really need to make it clear to the gay community, which it's not clear right now, that really condom use or some sort of HIV prevention technique is really a necessity if you want to stay HIV negative. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, you know, that message is out to a wide set of the gay community that of really how bad the epidemic really is at this point, especially in my generation.
Yeah.
And certainly not for adolescent gay men in high school. They're not getting any message about...
And it needs to be gay-targeted messaging. You know, you have to have...
Yeah.
You know, there's no sex ed in school, and I went to a very progressive liberal school that was, you know, talking about my sort of sex life. What you know, and it's very different. It's not analogous to heterosexual sex, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I got you. Fred in Madison. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Kathleen, I love your show, and I commend you for talking to your sons so openly about these things. And we are approximately the same age, and I'm from Wisconsin, and my background is Catholic. I cannot imagine my mother or father or I could not imagine them talking about such a subject openly with their kids. It simply was a non-thing. It wasn't as if it was repressed. It was simply not there. It was like division by zero. It was non-defined.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is a Puritanism of America, a kind of denial of sexuality, the idea that it's base and vile and, you know, the kind of gutter or yes, we have to deal with that, you know, the kind of barking dogs in the basement that have to be dealt with. But shifting the subject now, I don't think your callers focus on the gap between rich and poor. New York City is probably the richest city, the richest area in the United States. There's money to trickle down. If you are smart, you can access the money. I also notice your guests are talking about very expensive drugs. And I think there's a suspicion of the medical system, the pharmaceutical industry. So I don't know what to say. I don't agree with the 50% thing. It won't be that bad. But anyway, I just thought I would make these comments.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Mark for the response. Hi, Mark.
Well, a lot of issues raised there. I certainly agree that, for instance, in New York State, we had a law passed 20 years ago that required 6 days of HIV education in the schools. That is a law that remains on the books. However, the vast majority of schools are not doing that. So I agree with your caller that there is a real reluctance in this country, in many areas of the country, to talk about sex openly, certainly to talk about gay sex openly. In terms of New York City being rich, let's be clear, 1% of New York is rich, and the rest of us are struggling, and certainly young gay men of color are not rich. So they're dealing with, you know, survival tactics very often. And I agree, the drugs are, you know, certainly hugely expensive, which is why we need to pressure these drug companies to make these drugs available.
More available. Let's go to Curtis. We only have about a minute left. Hi, Curtis.
Hi, Kathleen. I really appreciate taking my call. My question is, how much different is the sexual practices of the lesbian, gay, transgender community than the heterosexual community? And my point is this. We're all doing the same thing, but for the vast majority of individuals, they look down on it when it comes to lesbian and gays.
All right. We only have about 15 seconds. Whoever wants to respond to that. Matthew, you want to?
Well, I can also say that biologically, the difference, I mean, men obviously have sex through their anus, and that there's only one cell wall, we would say. There's only one cell separating you from maybe possibly being exposed to HIV, whereas in through vaginal heterosexual sex, there's 40 cell layers there that can help protect against HIV. So you're automatically dealing especially in gay men, with a higher risk just through having gay anal sex.
But the risk
Thank you. We have to go. Thanks to each of you. We do want to give you a couple websites, thebody.com and our Facebook page. We'll put together a list of Facebook places or websites to go to find out more about this very important issue. Thanks to Mark Milano, HIV health and treatment educator, James Krellenstein, research intern at SUNY Medical School, and Matthew Rodriguez, who is with thebody.com. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. Thanks for your calls. News coming up, and we'll have another hour.